MacCast, Wednesday, November 9th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. It's been a pretty nice week so far this week for me. I hope things are going well for you, chugging along, and everything is going swimmingly. We've got a lot of really great Mac news to talk about this week. Also, some hints and tips and tricks, a little bit of feedback from you, good Mac geekery to dive into. But before we get to all of that, I think we should take a moment, thank one of our show sponsors, Furonix. They make a product called Deep Freeze. I've told you about it on the show in the past, but if you're an IT professional, if you're somebody who deals with multiple systems, Macs or PCs, it's completely cross-platform, and you need to deal with issues that might arise with those systems, well, Deep Freeze can help you save money. It can help make you have happier users, and it can protect those systems that you deploy out there from any bad stuff happening to them. And how does that work? Well, what I really like about this product is it's something that you can install, put on a system. Once you set up the configuration, you kind of lock it down, you define the areas that you want to protect, but then you can also set up something that they call thaw spaces. And these are areas of the system where users can actually store and persist and save data. So that could be something as simple as a folder you define on the system, maybe a document folder, an entire directory, or in the case of Mac OS X, an entire user folder or a home folder, or it could be even an external volume. And then once your users have the system, they can use it, they can write data anywhere. It's not locked down in such a way that it hinders their ability to use that system. But what it does is it allows you as an IT professional, if something goes wrong with that system, if something got written, maybe a virus got into that system, all you have to do is a simple reboot, and it's going to restore all your protected areas, the operating system, the core of that system, back to its original state. That simple, that easy. It can significantly reduce your IT and support costs, and it works with many popular remote access tools, things like Apple Remote Desktop. So if you're using that to manage an entire company or organization, that can come in really handy. And they have free trials and more information available on their website over at Furonix.com. So you can check it all out. Deep Freeze, and a big thank you to Furonix for their support of the MacCast. So what do you say we jump into some of our top stories for this week? We're going to kick it off with a really cool one, or a cool feature that may be coming to your iOS devices, your iPhones, iPod Touches, maybe even your iPads. Although it looks like something that Apple had in development and then decided to hold back. It's a little, well, they're calling it a hidden feature. It's actually a feature that is in iOS 5 and hasn't been enabled or turned on, but you can get it turned on if you're a developer or if you're a jailbreaker and you know how to get in and access, you know, a simple little control. Basically, developers have discovered that within the camera app, there is a hidden panorama feature, the ability to take panorama photos and have them stitched together. The way you enable it is you need to access a plist, a property list file within the operating system. So typically you need to have a jailbreak, or you can actually extract the file, modify it in your iPhone backup, and then restore it back on. I'm not going to get into the nitty-gritty of how you do it. If you're a jailbreaker, there's actually an app on Cydia where you can install this. But the setting or the entry that you need to add is enable firebreak. You set that to yes or true, and then when you launch the camera app, the built-in camera app, you'll see this new panorama button on the options screen. By pressing that, it'll give you instructions on how you can move the phone. You basically kind of swipe it or move it from left to right, and it'll take photos at the appropriate times, at the appropriate increments, and then stitch those together to make your panorama. And from the reports I've been reading, it works surprisingly well. As a matter of fact, many of the reviewers were saying, or the people that have tried this were saying, they don't understand why Apple actually nixed the feature, because it doesn't seem to have that many bugs. Although I did read one report that said kind of how you do it is a little bit clunky. So it may just be a UI thing. It may be something that Apple has some undiscovered bugs or issues with. Maybe they just felt that they didn't want to quite yet compete with some of the great third-party apps that are out there for doing panoramas. But either way, looks like it could be something that might show up in a future update. And if you don't want to wait, you can go online, figure out how to enable this. I don't know if it'd be worth doing an entire jailbreak just to enable this feature, but you don't have to jailbreak it. You do have to mess around with some backup files. So if you decide to do that, be very careful. You can always do a restore, but make sure that you back up your data on your device before you even attempt anything like this, just so you don't lose anything. But cool little hidden feature in iOS 5. So sometimes developers are rooting around within the operating system. They find cool features like this, or maybe additional information about upcoming software updates. Other times they actually just find holes or exploits in the security. And that's exactly what happened when infamous Mac hacker Charlie Miller was poking around in the operating system recently, or within iOS recently. You may remember Charlie Miller's name. He is known for being the guy that typically wins the Mac Pwn2Own competition at the hacking conference every year. This time around, it looks like he's focused on iOS and found a way to exploit the Nitro JavaScript engine to allow an application to execute unsigned code downloaded from the web. Now, Apple's rules for iOS apps forbid them from running any unsigned code. Basically, every developer is given a code signing certificate, and when you make an application, you have to sign your application before submitting it to Apple's App Store for review, and then they make sure that nothing bad is running within your application before they approve it and make that available for sale. The code signing part ensures that the application that's submitted comes from a known developer, and that nothing has been tweaked about it before it's received by the app review team. That all has worked really well up until recently, because Apple kind of made an exception for Mobile Safari for running unsigned code, and I'll explain that here in a second. But basically, Charlie Miller plans to reveal the details of this exploit at a security conference next week in Taiwan. For the record, he notified Apple of the security issue about 3 weeks ago. It was originally discovered after Apple released iOS 4.3. That was the first release that had the Nitro JavaScript stuff in it, and apparently still has not been patched, even as of the latest builds of iOS 5. The way it works is it takes advantage of a flaw, or a feature, I guess, that's part of iOS that checks to make sure that only Mobile Safari has the ability to create an area of memory that is both writable and executable. Most other applications can only write executable areas of memory or writable areas of memory, but not both. So you can't have something that gets downloaded within an app and then is able to be written and then executed. Well, Apple made an exception for Safari to be able to download and compile JavaScript code just in time for execution, and that aids in the performance and speeds up the performance of Mobile Safari. What Miller was able to do was build an app using this exploit that he found and bake this stuff in to his app. So basically, you launch the app. It looks fine at first glance, so it didn't alert the software reviewers at the App Store, but then he can make a call out to a server. It can download some code, I'm assuming JavaScript, and then compile and execute that within the app, and that code is completely unsigned. So that is definitely something that Apple doesn't want apps to be able to do. It can do it without anybody really knowing, without the user knowing, without Apple knowing. So it's a pretty big hole. He has been working with Apple on getting a fix, or at least Apple's been working on a fix since being notified by Miller. One report that I read said they even plan on crediting Charlie Miller in the release notes once the patch, or once the operating system is updated. They have done that in the past for some of his other exploits. But there's no word at this point on when the fix will be out, whether or not it'll be out before Charlie Miller exposes the details of the hack at this security conference next week. And Apple has had some time to get a fix out there. So I'd imagine they're scrambling at this point, planning on getting a release out. It may even be part of the planned upcoming release that's going to deal with some of the battery issues. And Apple, we know, has been working on that as well with iOS 5 and the iPhone 4S. So we'll have to wait and see. But you know, no matter how you feel about this stuff, I think it's good that we have people out there like Charlie Miller. A lot of people call him a white hat hacker because he finds these holes, he reports them to Apple, and gives them a chance to sort of patch them. I wish he wouldn't release the details till Apple has a fix out, because this could be pretty nefarious. It could do some bad things. And for the record, on his app that he put in the App Store, he did actually put this exploit into an application on the App Store. When he released details in a video this week of what he was doing, he indicated that the app was in the App Store. Apple promptly revoked his developer account. He can't get a developer license for a year. And they, of course, pulled the application from the App Store. As far as what it was doing, only the app installed on Charlie Miller's phone was actually downloading this nefarious code. So it's not pushing code out. There were some people that actually downloaded the application, which I think was like a stock app. They didn't get exploited code delivered to them, just for the record. But either way, not a good thing. And Apple wasn't too happy about it, as obviously indicated by them terminating his developer account. There was an interesting report out this week from web technology company Chitika that claims the number of people upgrading to iOS 5 is pretty dramatic. About 40% of iOS owners have already transitioned to the new operating system, according to their study or their numbers. They saw about a 20% adoption rate just after the first 5 days. After a month, they're showing that about 38% of iPhones, 30% of iPads, and 12% of iPod Touches connecting to their service are now running iOS 5. Now, as I was reading this report, I kind of thought about two things that it didn't really indicate and why these numbers might be a little bit higher than expected. A lot of the reports that I was reading were saying that this was focusing on the adoption rate of iOS 5. In other words, the number of people. To me, that sounds like the number of people that are moving or upgrading to iOS 5. That may or may not be the case, because all the new iPhone 4Ss that are coming on the market obviously are running iOS 5. So those would be included, I'm assuming, in these numbers. It wasn't really clear. I don't think they could make a distinction on their web service on whether or not these were new devices or devices that were, you know, upgraded from 4 to 3. The other thing interesting in this report was the small number of iPod Touches that were running iOS 5. And that seems to indicate more that the devices that they're seeing running iOS 5 are new devices, not existing devices that have been upgraded, because there weren't any new iPod Touches out there just, you know, launched with the new operating system. So you'd have to be upgrading your old Touch. And that was just kind of my observation of the numbers. Some other interesting numbers and observations came out this week from a Simco. Horace Dedu over there was looking at what he is calling the discard rate on iPhones, essentially the number of iPhones that were being put out of service and either not being handed down or reactivated, or somebody moving to a different phone on the network and not reactivating their iPhone or not getting a new iPhone. And the way he was doing that was he was looking at numbers from AT&T and Verizon. He was looking at the activation numbers versus the installed base. In other words, the total number of users on those carrier networks using iPhones. And what he found when he started correlating the numbers was that, again, about 50% of iPhones were being discarded over the last 7 quarters, actually about 56%, not being reactivated. But then he started breaking it down and looking at the numbers for the last 3 quarters. And he was looking at Verizon activations, and they were almost equal to the increase in the install base of iPhone owners. And that means that Verizon users are new to the iPhone. They're not replacing iPhones. So the small little difference, the increase in the install base that can't be directly attributed to new iPhone owners on Verizon's network, would be the number of iPhone owners added to AT&T's network. When he looked at the last 8 or 9 months, it looks like AT&T only added about 1 million new iPhone owners. So a majority of users on AT&T's network seem to be those who are upgrading and contributing to this idea of discards or discarded iPhones. And as a matter of fact, when he looked at the numbers further, it seemed to indicate that before the launch of the Verizon iPhone, the discard rate of iPhones on AT&T was about 60% and has since jumped up to about 81%. So most of new iPhone activations seem to be attributed to Apple adding new carriers in the U.S., I would assume Sprint and Verizon, and AT&T customers seem to be just simply upgrading their older iPhone devices. That doesn't seem all that surprising to me. I know that I upgraded my iPhone and contributed to one of those discards. I'm sure many of you did too. A lot of us don't like to change our carriers just on a whim. You know, you're kind of locked in, and once you have the ability to upgrade your phone on a given carrier, you're signing up for that new 2-year contract. So this didn't surprise me, but the numbers were interesting nonetheless. But the bottom line really is that Apple is still selling a lot of phones, whether they're people upgrading or new customers. They're selling a lot more phones, although maybe not as many as they would hope, at least according to some reports that came out from China and then were repeated by the DigiTimes. They said that Apple was cutting back on iOS device part orders, and they claim that it was because Apple saw slow in iPhone 4S sales after the initial pre-order boom. They said that they were reducing parts orders by about 10 or 15% until the first quarter of 2012. Now, not long after that report was rumored, analyst Maynard came out and said, poppycock, there's no way that that's happening. He didn't use that word, but in essence, balderdash, and he didn't use the word balderdash either, but said that, no, that's not what's going on. Is, you know, if anything, Apple may be reducing iPad parts orders, slowing those down in preparation of the fact that there should be a new iPad early in Q1 next year. But if you look at iPhone 4S sales, they're still incredibly strong. Stores are still selling out of inventory almost the moment that they get them, and shipping times are still 1 to 2 weeks. So there's no indication in the market that Apple would need to reduce parts orders for iPhone 4S. As a matter of fact, they probably need to keep them good and strong. So I wouldn't believe that report, and I don't think we need to worry about the number of iPhones Apple is selling. Apple recently settled a class action lawsuit over MagSafe adapters, and you actually may benefit from this one. A big surprise. Very often, we don't get much out of these settlements. But this time around, Apple is dealing with an issue that they're calling strain relief, where the MagSafe connector, or the other end of the connector on your power cable, will start to fray. The cord becomes thin and phrase at the power adapter. So if you were affected by that issue, Apple will in some cases replace the adapter. They have said that they reserve the right to determine whether the issue was the result of user damage, but if not, if they confirm that it was due to this flaw, they are going to replace your adapter free of charge. If you already had to replace your MagSafe adapter, there is a cash payment that you can receive to cover the cost of that. You just need to go to AdapterSettlement.com or call the phone number 1-888-332-0277 for more details. And these were the MagSafe connectors that kind of have the little T connector on one end, not the newer ones that are the kind of straight ones that are on most of the newer devices. This is the older style adapter. But if you've had issues with that, you probably want to go on Apple's website and check out the information about this support settlement, because you could be getting a new MagSafe adapter for free. Apple released an update for Java for Mac OS X this week, actually a pair of updates, Java for Mac OS X 10.6 Update 6 for Snow Leopard, and Java for OS X Lion Update 1, of course, for Lion. To install the version for Snow Leopard, you do need to be running 10.6.8, and it updates the runtime to the same version as the one used by Lion. Both updates deliver improved compatibility, security, and reliability by upgrading Java SE 6 to 1.6.029. The update also adds Cisco's AnyConnect mobility client and Microsoft UAG client to its blacklist and addresses 5 bugs, as well as a memory leak. On the blacklist side of things, that's a list of signed jars that contain serious security vulnerabilities that could be exploited by untrusted applets or applications. So that's why they're blocking Cisco and Microsoft's clients, because apparently they have those security holes in them. So that's a pretty big deal. If you use those clients, you may want to check into this a little bit more before you install this update, because your software might not work. So hopefully there's some updates for those client applications. You can get the updates by going to Apple's support website or via the software update utility. I assume if you're running Lion and you run software update, you'll only see this Java update if you already have Java installed, because Lion does not ship with Java pre-installed as part of the operating system. You'd actually have to run a Java application, and then it would require you to install Java at that point. It actually downloads it automatically. I use CrashPlan for my online backup, and that's a Java application. And the first time I ran that, I did have to install Java under Lion, and then I did see this update. If you don't see the update and you need Java installed on your system, you're probably going to have to grab the latest version via the support website. If you've been waiting and hoping that Siri might make its way to older iOS devices, 9to5 Mac might have some bad news for you. They got a response from Apple about whether or not they plan to support Siri on older devices, and the answer was no. That's even though the technology has been hacked to run on devices as old as an iPhone 3GS. And I've seen some of the videos. It seems to work pretty well on the older devices. The assumption is that since Siri is a major selling point for the iPhone 4S, it makes sense from a sales perspective for Apple to keep it relegated to only newer devices. This may irritate owners of older devices that now know it's actually technically possible to run the software. If you're going to run it on an older device, it sounds like you may have to jailbreak. And it's rare that Apple will sort of roll back software features to older devices, but they have done it. You know, anything is possible, and they do change their minds sometime. But right now, it sounds like the official word is they're not supporting it on older devices. I assume Siri will at least be part of newer hardware moving forward, so new iPod Touches, the next generation iPads will hopefully have it. No word officially on whether or not they will, but I don't think an iPad 2 or an iPad 1 will be getting the feature either. So that's disappointing to me, because I'm an iPad 2 owner. Probably will upgrade to an iPad 3, and Siri is just a pretty amazing technology. I have some hints and tips for you a little bit later on using Siri. And then finally in the news today, I think I told you about this on the last episode of the MacCast, Apple was planning on rolling out a new payment system in the Apple retail stores using the Apple Store app. That has gone live. It's their new Easy Pay system. It enables the ability for you to go into an Apple Store and make a purchase, specifically an accessory purchase, without having to interact with a salesperson at all. You essentially go into the store, you launch the Apple Store app, it'll recognize that you're in the store. You can take an item off the shelf, scan that item right in the app, and then pay using your Apple ID, your credit card that's on file and attached to your Apple ID, and then walk right out of the store. You don't have to interact with a single employee. As a matter of fact, they won't even stop you when you're walking out. Now, internally, there's been some rumors that Apple is calling this, some of the retail employees are calling this the easy theft system, because it does seem to make it easy to just sort of, you know, walk in, point your phone at a product, and then walk out. But I don't think that's quite going to happen. Apparently, you can buy any item that doesn't require a serial number to be registered. So if you need to buy a new iPhone or an Apple TV or something like that, those do have to get barcode scanned for a serial number. You're going to have to still work with an employee to make that happen. But almost anything else in the store, hard drives, accessories, cases, stuff like that, you can use with this new Easy Pay system. You know, it's going to be interesting to see if Apple has to start to deal with a new rash of shoplifting or an uptick in the number of items being stolen from stores. But my guess is that that's not going to increase. I think, you know, shoplifting is probably already a problem for them. They're dealing with it. I think the same kind of signs, you know, that security has to deal with in the store to catch a shoplifter. I think you're still going to look just as suspicious, even if you're kind of pretending to hold your phone up. I think you get that guilty look on your face. And I definitely don't think that the new system is going to turn someone who wasn't going to shoplift into a shoplifter. But talk to a couple people about this. And, you know, I do agree that it might make Apple stores a bit more of a target for shoplifting rings. And Apple definitely is going to have to deal with that. I would imagine some in-store kind of plain clothes undercover security is already a presence in most Apple retail stores, and they'll be, I'm pretty sure, watching out for this sort of thing. I can't imagine that they're just going to let it run rampant, but we'll have to see. I've talked to some people who have used this stump. They really like it. They say it's really easy, and I think most people are generally honest. So I see it as a huge advantage, especially in the upcoming holiday season. It's going to make it nice for people to be able to get what they want quickly and easily. It'll also reduce some of the strain on Apple's own staff, which gets really busy during the holiday times. And I'm hoping that it'll be a success because I'd like to see it stick around. And that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment, thank another one of our show sponsors, Gazelle. Actually, we're moving into the holiday season, and maybe you want to get some cash to get some new gadgets. Well, you can get cash for your old gadgets by going to gazelle.com. Really easy to do. You just go there. You do a simple search for the item that you have. They have an ever-growing database of stuff that they will buy, and you don't have to hassle with classifieds or online auction sites. In essence, if it finds a matching item, you answer a few quick questions about its condition, the kinds of accessories you have, and then they make you an upfront offer of cash. If you choose to take that and the item has value, they will pay the shipping and sometimes send you a box to send it in. And they also pay shipping both ways. So if you send something in, maybe there's a disagreement about the condition or the offer changes, they'll actually pay to ship it back to you if you want. So completely risk and hassle free. If you have an item that doesn't have value in the Gazelle system, they can even handle the recycling for you. And they do that responsibly with certified partners. And in that case, you do have to pay shipping, but at least you know your device isn't ending up in some landfill somewhere. You can get paid by check, by PayPal, by Walmart prepaid Visa or Amazon gift card, or you can even have the value of your item donated to one of over 100 charities that Gazelle works with and supports. So a really great service and an easy way to get cash back on your old stuff. You can check it out at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Now, I can't remember if I mentioned this on this show or some of the other shows that I've been on, but I'm loving my new iPhone 4S. One of the things that I love about it most is the new improved camera. It takes really great pictures most of the time. Although I'm kind of finding a little bit, it's not a bug, it's more of a feature in the iPhone 4S, iOS 5. I'm not sure if it's the two combined, but every once in a while I'm ending up with blurry pictures. And what's seeming to happen to me is that the software is actually focusing almost too fast, or actually refocusing, because what I'll do is I'll bring out my camera, I'll set up my picture, I'll tap to get the auto exposure, the white balance, and the focus in place, and then any slight movement, either of my subject or of myself, I'm a little bit shaky, I have to admit, but any little movement causes the camera to start to refocus, and a lot of times that's exactly when I'm pressing the button to snap my picture. It happens to me a lot, especially when I'm trying to take macro photos. So it's almost like they just need to slow it down a little bit so it doesn't try and resample just for a small shift in sort of the framing of the image or the picture that you're trying to take. The solution, luckily, I found is that you can use the auto exposure, auto focus lock feature. And I didn't even realize this feature was there until I was having this problem. But what I decided to do was see what would happen if I just tapped and held to set the auto focus, auto exposure. And when you do that, it'll kind of double blink, or the little box kind of flashes two times. And then down at the bottom, you see AEAF lock. And at that point, it won't try and do any more focusing or white balance auto exposure correction. It's kind of locked in place, and you can snap your picture, and that will maintain the focus and the exposure settings until you tap the screen again. So you can move the phone around a little bit. So this could be very useful too if you just want to focus in on an area and then even change the orientation of your picture. It's going to keep that focal point and that exposure setting. So that's really handy, and it's kind of fixed my problem. I'm hoping that Apple will tweak the software a little bit though, so that it's not quite as sensitive on the refocusing. Another new feature of iOS devices under iOS 5 and of the new version of iTunes is Wi-Fi syncing. And I've received a couple of emails from people who are having issues getting iTunes and Wi-Fi sync to work. And I just wanted to point out a couple things and mention something that a listener discovered. You do need, when you're using Wi-Fi sync in iTunes and on your iOS device, you need to have it on the same network, which I think makes sense. In most cases, most people do. But the other thing that you need to know is that for it to happen automatically, you need to be plugged in and connected to power. Now, even when those two things happen, you may run into issues where you're having trouble with your network. For some reason, it's not connecting. In those cases, I would recommend troubleshooting your Wi-Fi network. You may want to reset your router. Make sure that you don't have firewall on and ports blocked internally. Also, Robert discovered that in his case, he needed to make sure that both the sync this iPhone over Wi-Fi option and the open iTunes when this iPhone is connected options were checked in iTunes. Although I think, Robert, it may just be that iTunes does need to be open when you want to sync over Wi-Fi. If iTunes isn't open, you're not going to have the option to actually sync, even if you go into the settings and try and manually click the Sync Now button. So just be aware of that, because I know not everybody leaves iTunes open and running all the time, but you are going to need to do that if you want to use your Wi-Fi sync, say when you dock your iPhone, when you go to bed at night, maybe in your bedroom or something like that. Something kind of related to this is a cool little trick that someone emailed me about, where if you needed to sync your iPhone device and you were out and about and you didn't have your iPhone cable, you could use Wi-Fi syncing. And you might be thinking, well, don't I need to be on the same network? Yes, but you can create your own network and then do your syncing over that. I think a lot of people forget about the fact that if you have a Mac, say a MacBook Pro, a laptop, or something like that, you can create an ad hoc network, and that will allow you to sync over Wi-Fi without a cable. So if you're on your Mac, what you can do is you can go under the Wi-Fi item in the menu bar, and when you click on that, you'll see there's an option for Create Network. Pick that, a little dialog box will pop up, and it allows you to create computer-to-computer, or in this case, a computer-to-iPhone network. You can add a network name, set the channel, and then set up any security that you'd like. I typically, since I only do ad hoc networks temporarily, I just use the 40-bit WEP encryption, but you could do 128-bit, set a passkey, and then launch your network settings on your iOS device. Go under settings, under Wi-Fi, and then you should be able to see your new ad hoc network that's set up by your Mac. And then connect to that, enter the password if you set up WEP encryption, and then your two devices will be connected together, and then you can sync by initiating a sync from iTunes manually, or you could go in your device under settings, general, iTunes Wi-Fi sync, and you'll see the little Sync Now button. And that'll allow you to sync your content maybe when you're out and about. I had one listener who emailed me to let me know he was able to do syncing of a playlist he had created on his MacBook to his iPhone while he was on a train, while he was commuting home from work one night. That's a really cool feature. I've actually used the ad hoc network feature for a couple of reasons recently. I was giving a presentation and I didn't want to rely on the shared network for doing my Keynote remote application. So there's a cool iOS app for Keynote that allows you to control your slides. I wanted just a private network between my Mac and the remote application, and I used setting up an ad hoc network to make that happen, and that way I didn't have to worry about any interference or a slow network connection because a lot of people were on that network. I've also used it for giving presentations using my Apple TV and a Mac for demoing iOS applications using the new AirPlay mirroring feature. So I have my Mac kind of working as a base station, setting up an ad hoc network, and I connect the Apple TV and my iOS device to that, and it's like this private little closed network. And a little bit more reliable, and you can do that maybe someplace where you don't have access to WAN or any kind of Wi-Fi network. And it works really well, and it's easy enough to set up. Now, to destroy your ad hoc network or get rid of it once you're done, all you need to do is disconnect your Mac from that network by going under the little Wi-Fi icon in the menu bar, or just turning off Wi-Fi and then turning it back on the Mac. And then your little network goes away and you're all done. So cool little tip, and maybe some help with any Wi-Fi syncing issues that you might be having. And sort of staying on the topic of Wi-Fi, but this time from the other direction around, I guess, Walter has an issue where he has a Wi-Fi network that he's connecting to that he doesn't want to connect to. There's a free AT&T Wi-Fi network near his work, and his devices, his Mac, keeps connecting to that network, but he doesn't want that to happen because it's not a reliable network. It's not the network that he wants to be on. And the trouble generally is with the remember or the known networks feature that's built into iOS and Mac OS X. Once you've kind of connected to a known network, your Mac wants to keep connecting to that network. And the problem gets even worse when you connect to a base station or a network that has the same SSID or network name. So something like AT&T Wi-Fi, which every AT&T open mobile hotspot has that name. And if you have an iOS device, an AT&T iOS device, that's your network that it automatically connects to because you get free Wi-Fi access at AT&T Wi-Fi hotspots. Or I'm sure there's other ones. Boingo Wireless that's in the airports, or maybe you're on Orange, you know, over in the UK, and they have open Wi-Fi hotspots, and all the base stations are named the same. Or another common one I see a lot is Linksys. Every Linksys router by default has the network name or the SSID Linksys. And once you've connected to one, you might be at a friend's house. Their network name is Linksys as well. Your device is going to try and connect to that network. And if it's open, you might be connected to it and not even realize it. And that actually poses somewhat of a security risk. So probably the thing you want to do, Walter, is one, turn off the feature that says ask to join networks. The reason you want to turn this off is because that'll force your Mac to require you to manually join any unknown networks. It's not just going to happen automatically without you knowing. You're actually going to have to go in for networks that you haven't connected to before or that aren't in your known networks list. You're going to have to physically say, yes, I want to connect to that network. Now, at that point, you probably also want to go into your network settings on your Mac. So go into System Preferences, go into the Network Settings, and then click on Wi-Fi, and then click on Advanced. And in the Wi-Fi tab, you'll see a list of preferred networks. And under that, you will see, under that list, you'll see a checkbox that says, remember networks this computer has joined. You probably want to uncheck that feature as well, because that way you won't start building this list of known networks. Now, you may have some networks, say like your home network, that you do want to automatically connect to, and you want that to be a known network. Well, right above that little checkbox, there is a little plus icon, and you can manually add a Wi-Fi network to your preferred networks rather than having that happen automatically. So that gives you the ability to control which networks you connect to. Also in that list, that preferred networks list, you can click and drag any item in that list to kind of set up the order. So if you have certain place where maybe there's multiple networks that you can connect to, but one's your preferred one, you can rank that higher in the list or only include the one in the list that you want. Now, there's a similar setting on your iOS devices. If you go into settings and go into Wi-Fi, you'll see a little switch that says ask to join networks. Again, turn that off, and that means to join a new network, you're going to have to actually manually add it. Now, in both these cases, once you've added this network to your list, it's now in that preferred list. And I already kind of told you how to manage that on the Mac. That is a manual process. On iOS devices, once you've selected a network and you've connected to it, it automatically gets added to your preferred network list. You can't, you don't have an option to tell it not to automatically add those like you do on the Mac, which is a little bit annoying. So the other thing that you need to know how to do is how to remove maybe existing networks or networks that you're already connected to. On the Mac, it's really easy. In that same list that I told you about where you click the little plus symbol and you add a known network to the list, you can just select any one of the preferred networks in that list and hit the minus button to actually remove it. On iOS, you go into the settings, into Wi-Fi, and then you need to actually tell it to forget known networks or networks that you've connected to in the past. And again, this all becomes a bigger issue when you start connecting to networks that have the same name. AT&T Wi-Fi is a really egregious one because, like I said, every AT&T Wi-Fi hotspot has the same name. So once you've connected to one in one location, it's going to try to always connect to another one in another location, even though you might not want that to happen. So you need to go in here and remove it from the known list. The way you do that is you go into the Wi-Fi settings, you'll see the list of known networks. You can click the little blue arrow next to the name of the network. And then in the next screen at the top, you'll see an option that says forget this network. And you can click on that, and then that will remove it from the list. And then the next time you need to connect to a network with that name, you'll have to go through the process of actually manually selecting that and connecting to it again. And once again, it'll get added back to your list. And then you'll need to remember to remove it again if you don't want it to keep trying to connect to that same quote-unquote known network. I wish the system was a little bit smarter to not just use the name of the network, but that seems to be the case. That seems to be how it works. You'd think it could use something like the MAC address or the IDs of those networks to make it a little more secure. But Walter, that's probably the issue that you're having. Hopefully this information will help you fix that. So since the release of iCloud, I have been playing around with the different services and different options and stuff like that, and also with my new iPhone 4S and iOS 5 on my devices, including my iPad 2. I've been playing around with Apple's new PhotoStream service, and I actually am really enjoying it. It's great to have the feature where I take a photo with my iPhone, and it's magically and automatically added to my iPad and also shows up in iPhoto on my Mac. I absolutely love the feature, but I was a little bit confused about it when I started using it. And I still am slightly confused about how some of it works. I shouldn't say confused because that's probably not right. I understand how it works, but I question a little bit why it works the way that it does. But once I kind of started to understand how it works, it's starting to make sense to me. And I was hoping to maybe share some of my insights with you and just get your opinions on whether or not you're liking the new PhotoStream service. So in case you don't know what it is, PhotoStream is part of Apple's new iCloud service. It allows you to take the most recent 1,000 photos from your iPhoto, your Aperture, and you can only pick one or the other. You can't mix and match. So if you have iCloud connected to iPhoto, it's connected to iPhoto. If you have it connected to Aperture, it's connected to Aperture. If you use both applications, you're going to have to pick which one you want to sync with the photo stream. But it allows you to take the most recent 1,000 photos from either of those, along with photos taken on your iOS devices, and sync them to your iCloud account, to your photo stream. And the way I started to have to think about this is, especially with my iOS devices, think of it as having this sort of 1,000 picture virtual memory card that allows you to only store your images on that space or reformat, blank out that space and start adding more images to it. It's not like an album or a folder that you put pictures into and then you manage them from there. It really just is kind of this storage area that then lets you sync your photos or bring your photos over to other locations, say the photo library on your iOS device or the photo library on your Mac in iPhoto or Aperture. It's really kind of this virtual memory card. And once you start thinking about it that way, it kind of starts to make sense because you can't edit the photos in your photo stream. You can't delete or remove individual photos in your photo stream. The nice thing about photo stream is that it doesn't count against your iCloud storage. So with a free iCloud account, you get 5 gigs of storage. Those 1,000 images that are in your photo stream do not count against that. So how do you use photo stream? Well, turning it on is pretty easy. You need to turn it on your Mac, and you need to be running OS X Lion, and you also need to turn it on into your iOS devices, the devices that you want to use with photo stream. So on iOS, you go into your settings, you go under photos, and you turn on Photo Stream. I think you can also turn it on by going into settings, into iCloud, and using the Photo Stream setting there. I think the two are connected, and this is one thing with iOS that I think Apple's doing that's a little bit confusing, is sort of having more than one area where you can control turning on or off a feature. I think from a UI perspective, that's not a really good choice, but there are those two locations. I think one impacts the other. I haven't played around with it enough to know if they're separated. I think once you turn one off, it turns it off in the other location as well, which again is just kind of confusing to me, but just something to be aware of. On the Mac, you need to go into your system preferences, into iCloud, and then turn on Photo Stream. You can also, again, do it from within your application. So inside iPhoto, and I would assume inside Aperture, I don't own Aperture, so I don't know if this is the case. If you go into Preferences, there's a Photo Stream tab in iPhoto, and you can enable Photo Stream from there. And then you get a couple of different options. You have the option to automatically import your photos into your library. And what that means is that once a photo gets into your Photo Stream, it will automatically add those photos back into your main library. Because remember, you cannot edit the photos in the Photo Stream. You need to actually move them into your iPhoto library. So if you don't have the automatic import turned on, you actually have to go to the Photo Stream, grab the pictures, and manually drag them into your iPhoto library. So I like to have that feature on because that way they automatically show up in iPhoto when I'm ready to kind of edit and manage them, move them to albums and stuff like that. You also have the option in the iPhoto settings to automatically upload your photos from iPhoto into the Photo Stream. And that means any photos that you add into your iPhoto library will automatically get added into your stream and then synced over to your iOS devices that are connected to that Photo Stream. On your iOS devices, your pictures, because if you're taking them with the camera roll, those would automatically be in your iPhoto library. If you've added something through iPhoto and it's in your Photo Stream and you want to get it on your iOS device, it will show up in the Photo Stream section, but it's not in, you have to remember that it's in the cloud. It's on your Photo Stream in the cloud. It's not necessarily saved locally on your device. You still have access to it, but if you want to have it permanently in your library in your iPhoto, in your iOS device, you're going to need to select that and save it into your camera roll, save it into your photo library to keep it there. Otherwise, once your 1,000 pictures, you know, fill up, it could get rolled off. And if you don't have another copy of it someplace else, then that could be an issue. So that's kind of how you turn Photo Stream on. That's how photos get into your Photo Stream and how you kind of manage them in terms of getting them out into your local libraries. What happens if you want to clear the stream? What happens if you want to just reset things? You want to, quote unquote, reformat that virtual Photo Stream kind of memory card, if that's how we're thinking about it. And that process is, once again, I think a little more confusing than it should be. The first thing you should know is make sure that you've moved any photos from the stream and from your devices onto your Mac or into your camera roll, into your iOS photo library. You don't want to lose them. I already mentioned, but I'll restate it, on your Mac, if you're in iPhoto, if you're in Aperture and you don't have that auto import option on, you need to manually move them from your Photo Stream into your iPhoto library. However you do it, get them into your iPhoto library. I think that's the safest place for them to live if you want to keep them on your camera roll, on your iOS device, but really I like having them on my Mac. And once you've done that, then back up your photos. Make sure that you have a backup. I don't want anybody to lose any photos. Can you tell I'm a little paranoid about telling you this tip? Because we're eventually going to wipe out your Photo Stream. So you want to make sure you have a copy of everything that is in your Photo Stream somewhere locally, not just in the cloud. Once you've verified doing that, then you need to go to the cloud. You need to go to iCloud.com. Log into your iCloud account, and then once you're in there, go to the upper right where you see your account name, click on that and go into the account settings, and then from there, click on the advanced button, and then you will see the option to reset Photo Stream. Click that, and you'll note below that button that it says this does not remove the photos from your devices or your computer, so you're still going to find those there. We're going to have to do some other steps to actually remove and purge those images. This only clears the iCloud storage, the online storage. So once you've completed that process, then we need to go to each each Mac that has PhotoStream turned on and each device that has PhotoStream turned on and clear the images out from the PhotoStream there. So on your Mac, go into the PhotoStream settings in the preferences in iPhoto and uncheck the enable PhotoStream box. When you do that, it's going to warn you that it is going to delete the existing content. Since you have your backup, you should be okay with that. Go ahead and click OK, and that will purge the photos out of the photo stream on your Mac. If you have the auto import feature on, of course, they're going to be in your main library, so you should be safe. On your iOS devices, you're going to do a similar thing. You're going to go into settings, you're going to go into iCloud, and you're going to go to the photo stream setting and toggle it to off. It once again will warn you that it's going to remove the content from your device. Say OK, and then that will reformat or wipe out the photo stream on your iOS device, and you can start over. You can turn it back on, and you'll have a clear photo stream to start working with again. I don't see much of a reason to clear out the photo stream. Some people might want to do it if you've got some images in there that you're not particularly happy with. That's the weird thing about using photo stream. Like I said, it's like this virtual storage card that you can't really get images out of. They just kind of naturally flow through this card unless you do this reset procedure. So I have photos in there, you know, snapshots or screenshots I take a lot that I don't want to keep in my library. I delete them, but they're still in my photo stream. And that can be a little bit annoying because I'm one of those people that likes to clean stuff out. I don't like having these little bits and pieces that I don't want around, that I don't need copies of someplace, but they're kind of stuck in there. You cannot go in and delete individual items from your photo stream. It's an all or nothing thing, which I kind of don't like. So I'm hoping maybe that changes in the future, that we are given some sort of ability to selectively delete items out of the photo stream, or at least maybe mark things to get purged a little bit earlier. Maybe even on a hierarchy, it'd be great to even just say, hey, you know, these screenshots I don't care about, delete those first before you take other items out of my photo stream when it becomes full, when I reach my 1,000 limit, because it'll start to roll off the oldest stuff to make room for the newest stuff, or at least that's my understanding of how it works. So that's PhotoStream. I kind of like it. I'm using it quite a bit, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts and opinions if you're using it or if you've had any luck or know any tricks for working with the PhotoStream. Send those along, maccast@gmail.com. Here's a real quick one for you. I received an email from Mike, and he sent me a link to these really cool PDF cheat sheets that show you the key combinations for typing special characters on your Mac. So I'll have a link to these in the show notes at maccast.com. It's through a site called gosquared.com. But they're characters like, say you needed to type the pound sterling symbol, you know, if you're writing out a price for maybe a UK product. That's Alt-3. If you need to do a bullet, I've known this one for a while, but it's really handy. Option-8 will type a bullet. And maybe you want to type a square root symbol. Well, that's Alt-V. These cheat sheets have all of those cool keyboard shortcuts. And, of course, a classic one that a lot of people like to know is how to type the Apple logo. In any system font, you can type Shift-Alt-K, and that will give you the Apple logo. They have these available as sort of one giant PDF, or there's actually separate little sheets depending on the character sets that you want to get the keyboard shortcuts for. If you don't want to learn the keyboard shortcuts, you can, of course, always use the built-in character viewer that's in Mac OS X. If you go into your system preferences under keyboard and check on the option that says show keyboard and character viewers in menu bar, you'll get this little character viewer icon up in your menu bar. If you go up under that and choose show character viewer, you will get this giant list. And we've talked about this tip before, but you'll get this giant list of all the different characters and symbols and stuff like that that are available on your Mac. And then to use those, all you need to do is find the one that you're interested in within the list and drag it into your document, or you can put your insertion point where you want to type that character and then just double click it in the character viewer and it will insert it. And just as an aside, the Japanese emoji characters, those are the little emoticons or little funky icons of animals or people and stuff like that that we've seen on iOS before. Those are built into Mac OS X now with Lion, and those are available from the character viewer also. So if you've been wondering how to type those out, turn on your character viewer and you'll see a section called emoji, and you can pick the symbol you want and just drag it into your document or your your tweet if you're working on Twitter. I see those a lot on Twitter quite a bit. So that's how people are able to type those out. But if you're like me, you like keyboard shortcuts for stuff, check out these lists from Mike. And thanks for sending those in, Mike. And then finally today, I promised you some Siri tips, and I have a good one from Doug. I've been using Siri on my iPhone 4S. I'm really enjoying it for taking notes and just adding things into my iPhone data while I'm in the car. Sending texts has been particularly useful, or reviewing my schedule, something like that. Setting a reminder is another great one that you can do. But Doug had a good bit of advice for composing emails with Siri, something that I hadn't really thought about. And he mentioned that he has started to start composing emails in Siri. And then when it pops up and it asks you if you want to send your email message, if you actually click on the message in the Siri interface, it will open up that email. Rather than sending it, it will open up that email in the Mail application. And now in the Mail application, you could bring up the on-screen keyboard to finish typing out that if you're not driving. Or if you're driving, you could even hit the annotation button on the keyboard to maybe fill out the email, do a little bit more text-to-speech or speech-to-text stuff, and get the email actually finished off. And then another nice trick I like about doing this is that once you're in the Mail application, you can change the from address, the sending address. Very often I want to compose an email, but I don't want it coming out of my default account that's attached to email in the emails that Siri sends. So at this point, I could change the sender and send it from a different address. Another cool tip is that if you want to finish up the email later, so maybe you want to start it with Siri, get it ready to go, and then save it as a draft. Once you're in the Mail application, you can hit cancel, save it to your drafts, and then when you get back to your Mac, it'll show up in your drafts folder if you're using, say, like an IMAP account that's syncing, and then you can finish it from your Mac. So you can get a bunch of emails kind of started up, ready to go, and then just finish them off and send them when you get home later. So I thought that was a really cool tip and something that some of you might find helpful. The other thing that I discovered the other day was when I was taking notes, I asked Siri to take a note. I started composing a note, and then I wanted to add some stuff to it. It had already finished kind of doing its whole speech-to-text thing, and just on a whim, I tried pressing the Siri button and saying again, saying add to note, and then it just asked me, what do you want to add, and went back into the note interface, and I was able to add another paragraph to my note. And then digging in further, I kind of looked at the help, and it gives a great example of maybe you wanted to make a reading list, so you can say something like, make a reading list note, and then add book titles to it. And then maybe a couple days later, you might have a new title you want to add. You can simply say, add the Steve Jobs biography to my reading list note. And it will know the reading list note you had set up because you called it reading list note, and it will know to add the additional information to that note. I played around with this, and it does get a little bit wonky depending on context and some of the keywords. Like if I tried to use a name and it was the name of a person in my contact list, add that to a list, it would sometimes just bring up the contact information rather than adding it to the note. The other thing I noticed is that sometimes it was trying to add to a list. If I were use the keyword list, it tries to add to iReminders and got a little bit confused with that. So Siri is beta. There's some things they need to work on, but those are kind of some cool tips and tricks that you might find useful. And I guess related to kind of the email thing where you can tap on stuff in the Siri interface, a lot of people don't know if you've set a command into Siri and it gets the translation wrong, if it does the text to the speech to text wrong. Keep wanting to say that backwards. If it translates what you're saying incorrectly, you can tap on the little bubble that shows the results of what Siri thought you said, and you can actually bring up the keyboard and you can edit that, and Siri will reprocess the command and get it correct. So just another little tip if you're playing around with Siri, you may or may not have discovered that. So that's going to do it for today's episode. Before I leave you, I want to thank all of my show sponsors, Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software. Get more information and details over at furonix.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software. Get more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. Check out their software. Get more information and details as well as free trials over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, get cash for your gadgets. You can do a search and get more information and details over at gazelle.com. Big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for staying subscribed, for listening. Don't forget, if you want more MacCast, you can become a MacCast member. I have information and details as well as pricing on the MacCast member program over at member.maccast.com. But in essence, you get new episodes each week and some additional content, mostly focused on the hints and tips and tricks and deep diving into some subjects that we typically don't cover on the MacCast, or going a little more in depth than we typically can on the MacCast. So check that out. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, or you're welcome to leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast, and be sure to check out the MacCast.com website. There you'll find show notes with links to anything I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. And while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. There's also the MacCast Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/the MacCast, or you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, and I'll look forward to seeing you online. That's going to do it for today. I do have some new music for you today. This is a track from somebody I actually met at BlogWorld. I did a presentation at BlogWorld Expo this year, and she was out in the audience, emailed me afterwards and said, "Hey, I'm an artist. I've got a track I'd like you to play." I took a listen. It sounds great. It's awesome. If you need more information on her and maybe upcoming shows and stuff like that, you can find that. I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. I also have a link to her album on iTunes. So if you like the track, I would encourage you to head there, buy the music and support the artists that you hear on the MacCast. That's always appreciated. The track is called Break Me by Alex Calise. Enjoy, and I will see you all next time.
There's nothing left to say, nothing to figure out. I know your ammo, baby. Why don't you shut your mouth? This girl don't live here no more. She left a bad